good evening. I'm Dick Tropp, and along with some other members of our staff at the People's Temple Agricultural Project, here in the radio room with us, we have several people who have come in to visit us today to see our physician at the Jonestown Clinic. We are out here in the Northwest District near Port Kaituma, and everyone who's come is here from the Port Kaituma area. They are only a sample of many people who come in regularly, and we are very happy to be able to help. We hope to be expanding our medical services in the near future so that we can render an even better and more extensive service. To begin with this evening, I'm going to ask first a young man who's come in today named David Ben from Port Kaituma. David, maybe you can just explain why you came today to visit us.
Well, I came in here to Jonestown and a disease was uncertain of. I heard about the People's Temple, Agriculture Mission, have the clinic. And I came here to see that this clinic carries out the service because I have a disease, I don't know what is it. And they was able to render it by explaining to me what it was about. Well, the doctor told me the necessaries, and I appreciate this treatment, also the cooperation of the people, at Jonestown, the cooperation that they show me. Nice people, and I can see many of them are happy. And I like the intention. They're trying to develop the medical service in the near future to come.
Thank you very much, David. Okay. And next here is a young man named Dennis. Is that welcome? Okay. Okay, Dennis. How come you've come in today to visit? Did you came to visit the physician? Is that right? Okay. And can you tell us just maybe something about why you came in? Thank you. Next, we have a man named Archie George from 4 Mile, and I'd like to ask Archie just to briefly explain why he visited the medical clinic today and what happened. Could you tell us just briefly why you came in? Okay.
My name is Sarah Tropp, and I'm at one of the teachers in the community school here, and I see a young man here who looks like one of our school children. He's just about the right age. What's your name?
Ryan Gorms.
He's a bit hoarse with a cold. Well, his mother is right over here. Why don't I chat with her for a minute? We can talk about why she came to the clinic, and I think it was to help out her son here. This is Mrs. Gorms, and that was her little son, Brian, who was a little hoarse there. Is that why you brought him to the clinic?
Yes.
And how did you find the treatment here?
The treatment up at People's Temple is very nice. That's why I decided to bring my son up here this morning. The People's Temple, they are always willing to attend with any kind of sickness.
You have a very beautiful son, and I'm sure he'll be feeling well very shortly. He's a very, very handsome young man. Next, we have Judy Calestro, a very beautiful young lady who's come here today also to see the doctor. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what was the problem you had, and you know, how did you find the treatment here, and just why you came to the clinic.
This morning, today I came here to Jonestown to see the doctor, and there was very good attendance from People's Temple. They're attentive.
You think was a thorough examination, or they?
Yes, I was on the examinations a few minutes ago, and the medicine thing that I get, I believe in myself it would help me. And they was very kind very attentive.
Thank you very much, Judy. Right here we have Juliet Calestro, who's Judy's very lovely sister. And why did you come to the clinic? Was it for yourself or was it for one of your children?
I'm here to bring my baby this morning because she had the diarrhea.
She had had diarrhea. When you brought her in, did you feel that you got prompt attention, quick treatment?
Yes, I got good attendance this morning when I came here to bring my baby.
Did the doctor, after looking at your baby, give some kind of medication for the baby for you to take, or did he prescribe anything for you to give to the baby?
The baby gets some medicine. I hope the baby would feel much better.
Very good. And on the whole, are you satisfied with the kind of care that you and your baby got when you came here to the Jonestown Clinic?
Yes, I'm satisfied with the care that the baby gets when they come here this morning.
Very good. Thanks so much, Juliet.
One returns after the interrogations. The optimist, positive thinkers among us think that those men may be on their way home. You can't hear from where we are the lists of those being released as they are read out on the football pitch of the big stadium next to the cycle track. The pessimists, those that look on the cynical side like I do, and that's the way a revolutionary always must think, be prepared to be the best revolutionary. Those pessimists amongst us think that those of us, those who have undergone the interrogation, will next be isolated right after here at the cycle track. The cubicles and cloakrooms of the swimming pools are filled with women prisoners. It's getting hotter, and my head is beginning to ache. On the concrete cycle track, Aguilo Uno, the officer, is making a speech before women from the National Health Service, the Socialist Health Services that were doing such a wonderful job for the children people. He is showing bullets to them. He even lets some of them feel the bullets to see for themselves that they are for real. He points in our direction as he does so, apparently telling them that he found the bullets in our pockets. It's just after 4 p.m. now. There are four of us left. A while later, two. Now I'm the only one. One of the guards walking past me touches my knee and thrusts a piece of bread into my hand, whispering that I should hide it quickly. I slip the bread into a pocket of my jacket and hurriedly slip half of it into my mouth. The feeling of hunger is dulled a little bit, but I'm still terribly thirsty. It's now 4:45 p.m. The same tall Air Force officer reappears. "We'll interrogate you tomorrow morning," said he. This announcement upsets me. Without an official questioning, there is no hope of being released. The previous questioning apparently does not count. "Come on, we still have little time." "Come on," he said. I walk down the stairs, pulling my jacket on as I go. I step beside the officer. I stop there on the landing. He indicates the door, and I step into a gloomy corridor where there is a little table and three chairs around it. There's one more officer. The table is strewn with papers and cigarettes. I come up to the table. The officer follows me. The two officers exchange comments about how cold or how hot it is, and that they are still waiting for their meal to be brought in. They sit down. Both wear dark glasses. Both are solidly built and broad-shouldered. By the look of it, they are pilots. Both are captains, or perhaps majors, if their age is any guide at all. I sit down on the vacant chair and lean against the back. The dark glasses make it impossible for me to follow the direction of their gaze. But I have a feeling that they are studying me. They look calm. If a bit tired. Nonetheless, calm. That means the main thing is for me to avoid irritating them. It looks as if either one of them could pack a very nasty punch. It would be stupid of me to get them to prove it. You say you're a communist. Since when? I say since 1950. Did you belong to the Young Communist League too before joining the party? No, I did not. Were you jailed under Don Gabriel Gonzalez's government? No. You must have been quite a big shot in the party if you managed a radio station. No, I was not. I was an ordinary member. I was put in charge of the radio station on the strength of my long experience of radio work. That's the only reason. You're a journalist, aren't you? What was your paper? I worked on El Siglo. One of the officers is seated opposite me. The other to my side. I wish I could see their eyes, but all I can see is my own reflection in the glasses of the other officers opposite me. The communists ran the country's economy and ruined it. Yes, unfortunately, there were mismanagement and mistakes. The government made no secret of that, I said. What do the communists think of the armed forces? We thought that the armed forces should cooperate with us running the country. What? With communists? With President Allende's government, with the popular unity, I thought. Yes, I thought the armed forces should work with us. You were planning to set up a dictatorship. No, all we wanted was to implement, to help the program of the popular unity government. We wanted your help to do so. The task was difficult, but the goal was to complement the country's sovereignty with economic independence. That's right, you wanted to bring us under a dictatorship. At one point I even wanted to resign and leave Chile, said the officer. I toyed with the idea of moving to Venezuela because I could not live under a dictatorship. I made no comment. It was not a question, and I was not bound to reply. It was he who had brought up the subject. He started to stumble when he began talking about dictatorship. For what was he obtaining in Chile now? The vicious dictatorship was so apparent. Apparently he realized that he had put his foot in it. I was one up on him. This gave me confidence. As long as they were asking general questions on the subject of Chilean politics, I was on sure ground. The man still too concerned about his life. Revolutionaries just have to conquer that. Why were you trying to undermine discipline in the armed forces? So, as far as I know, the Allende government had no wish to see poor discipline in the armed services. On the contrary, it sought to enlist the cooperation of the armed forces to help its program, which was well known to everyone and commanded wide support amongst the people. That's a lie. You were trying to bribe the senior officers. The Air Force officers we arrested had dollar checks signed by Luis Corvalan. He was the head of the Communist Party. He was on the attack now. It was a monstrous lie. He was trying to draw me into an argument in order to catch me out. I was tired, but not that tired. If I managed to keep calm and a clear head, I could handle him easily enough, I thought. This sounds incredible, senor. Corvalan is not rich. He lives on his senatorial salary. I don't think it's large enough for him to buy dollars. He has no bank account. And besides, as you well know, the communists who held high government posts only kept as much to live on as a skilled industrial worker makes, donating the rest for financing the building of kindergartens, nurseries, and free hospitals. Communists are men of modest means. What was the code cut radio used? We didn't have any. Why did the broadcast on September 11? What did you broadcast? The cut appealed to the workers to stay at their jobs. What else? Nothing else. your plane smashed our main radio, our radio mast, on the very first bombing run. We were bombed off the air. If they are really pilots, they should be flattered to hear this. The bombing was certainly accurate. It is getting on towards 6 p.m. The piece of bread and the cigarette are still in my pocket. I am dying for a smoke, but if I smoke, I'll show my weakness. And if I start eating the bread, I'll show disrespect. Patience, I say to myself. Dr. Allende was a communist, wasn't he? No, senor, he was a socialist. You know him personally? Yes, senor, I met him in 1952, at the time of his first election campaign, when he was running for the presidency for the first time. Later, I campaigned for him during the subsequent election campaigns. Why? The communists always supported him. When he became president, you lined your pockets, didn't you? No, senor. We communists worked together with Allende to get into office and effect the changes in Chile that we thought were necessary, not to enrich ourselves. I can assure you, I don't even have a telephone at home, nor a car of my own. You searched my house, so you should have an idea how well off I am. But your bosses had all that. No, senor, they lived modestly. The officer who had been thinking of making his home in Venezuela was doing all the questioning. The other was sitting to my right, and I could hear him breathing hard. At that time, Venezuela, by the way, was much further to the right than it is now. President Perez has been moving left of center, democratically, and in the interest of the third world, that is Venezuela, 10 miles east, our neighbor. The officers looked tired. They must have been questioning since 8 in the morning. If so, they must certainly be tired by now, and the more so the better. It was in my interest for the questionnaires to go on and on, but as long as they didn't get irritable, of course. Give us the names of the MIR. That's the left-wing revolutionary movement. MIR members who work for your radio station. All staff members of Radio Recabarren, R-E-C-A-B-A-R-R-E-N, were taken on their worth as specialists. Their party affiliation was unimportant, as long as they were not hostile to the government. I can answer questions concerning myself personally. I don't know much about the others. We communists are rather like military people. We simply don't ask certain questions of our friends, and we don't even discuss certain things with our wives. The other left-wing parties also stick to this rule. They started putting the same questions to me as they had done in the beginning, slightly changing the wording. They repeated the procedure several times. However, the interrogation appeared to be more like a conversation than anything else. They asked me about my family and about my earnings. They also asked me if my children went to school or were at work. And again, they asked me about the plan Zeta, Z-E-T-A. You wanted to stir up civil war after first getting the top-ranking officers out of the way. Do you know anything about the plan Zeta? I first heard of it here at the stadium. But other detainees were conflicting versions of it. I've been in isolation since September 11th. We haven't been reading papers or listening to the radio. We know absolutely nothing about what's going on outside the stadium. But at least you know that the Communist Party has been outlawed and an end has been put to its political irresponsibility, along with the infamous Popular Unity. You are aware that power is in our hands now, and that all our orders are carried out. That much you know, I hope. I know that the armed forces have come to power. And what do you think of it? I have no idea what is happening beyond these walls. All I know is that tragic things have occurred in my life, and in the life of my friends, who are in the same boat with me. I must say quite honestly that I deeply regret what has happened. Asked for it by your propaganda that hopped on the same tune day in and day out, and by your protest songs, your radio station was quite clever in turning out its propaganda. Unfortunately, that is not so, or I would not be here. Nor would we. We would be lying in our graves, wouldn't we? We mishandled our propaganda work, and this is one of the mistakes to which we owe our defeat. But you had quite an audience. Did you have any influence on the cut? Among left radio stations, the most popular were Portales, Magallanes, and Corporacion. What about the Russian-made equipment we found at your radio station? The equipment was made in Czechoslovakia. We didn't have a chance to even use it. But if you had, you would have had the most powerful radio station in Chile, wouldn't you? No, it would have put us in the medium range. The kilowatt, the right-wing radio stations such as Agricultura, Coachiva, Mineria, and Chilena had 100 kilowatt each. Besides, Agricultura has equipped enabling it to double its broadcasting range if necessary. You realize, of course, that 100 kilowatt is enough power for countrywide broadcasting coverage given suitable relay stations. The conversation then turns to the equipment and broadcasting output of the various radio stations and their impact. And again, they put questions that I've already repeatedly answered earlier on. Do you know anything about communist plans directed against us? No, senor. They are sure to go back to their old game, as they did under the government of Gonzalez Videla. They'll scatter like so many ants and go into hiding and start reorganizing their ranks after camouflaging ourselves, themselves. That is, they'll start creeping into every crack and hole seizing power. Am I right? I said, yes, senor. And what are you going to do if we set you free? I'll go back to work. I can hardly hope to land a job with any of the newspapers you have left untouched. Nor can I get my radio job back. But I have an amateur radio workshop at home. If all goes well, it might just bring in enough money to live on. My son will help me set it up. Set about it as soon as I get back home, for my family's on the brink of financial disaster, I'm sure. I'm afraid, indeed. I know that our radio station has been seized, and the staff did not get their wages or benefits. The Social Security laws operate in much the same way as always. It's getting dark. A cold wind is blowing through the corridor. One of the officers takes out a mimeograph text from a desk drawer and hands it to me. It is an undertaking not to engage in any political activity and not to attend meetings and rallies. Are you prepared to sign it? With one provision, I am no longer young, and I cannot renounce my convictions. That was a brave statement. I like that. No one is persecuted for that in this country. We're not fighting ideas, you can be assured. This is a serious document. We always carry out our promises, unlike you, who always went back on your word. The Allende government was notorious for its bad faith, but if we catch you doing anything unlawful, God himself will save you from prison. Well, do you want to sign it? Yes, I'll sign it. Does this mean I'm going to be placed under house arrest? No, you may lead a normal life. Naturally, whenever you leave town, you had better let the police know where you are going and for how long. But I repeat, any participation in demonstrations, rallies, and trade unions is banned. Do you agree? Yes. Yes, I agree. He calls in a soldier, gives him some paper, and orders him to lead me away. As I leave, I can hear them get up, sigh with relief, and complain that they still haven't been brought anything to eat. As I come out of the corridor, I merge into a world of diffused fluorescent light. It is 8 p.m. I turn around and look with distrust. Is the interrogation really over? What kind of trap have they set me? Why has everything turned out to be so simple? Perhaps it's just a respite. a brief period of rest. Although they really set me free, I try to go back over their questions again and my answers. The officer doing all the questions had kept fingering his ballpoint most of the time rather than using it to put down my answers at all. I couldn't see their eyes because of their glasses. They, on the other hand, could study every one of my expressions. Everything seems to indicate they are going to release me. Tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, when I was questioned at the Defense Ministry, they threatened me with 60 days of imprisonment. I have done 20. Another 40 days to go. Month. If they set me free, I'll be able to celebrate Christmas and the New Year at home. So far, one thing is certain. They are keeping me in detention, keeping me in prison because of my party, my Communist Party membership. They've had enough time to get the lowdown on me, and I'm sure they know a lot more than I can imagine. A feeling of tiredness suddenly overcomes me. My eyes keep closing. I light a cigarette. At the same time, swallow down the remainder of the bread in my pocket. When it reaches my stomach, I have a tickling sensation. Some of you have never known hunger. You should. You'd be better prepared to see that our children were never tortured, to resist until the end, to never let fascism take us over. The interrogation is over. I feel rather much like I did after a successful examination back in my school days. Even if you don't know what mark you're going to get, you are at least sure that you showed a good grasp of your subject. And another feeling, as if you had walked along a razor edge and did not cut yourself even once. Back at the stands of the cycle track, they split us into three groups. A gill sees to it that we do not talk. We wait in silence for about an hour. My comrades ask me by sign language, "How are things?" I'm all right. I respond by an appropriate gesture. "And you?" "We're all right too," one of them replies. "Not too bad," another gestures to me. Agila Uno is again haranguing the nurses and showing them bullets. They pretend that they are listening to him carefully. At last he reads out a list of names and orders us to line up on the field of the cycle track. We form rectangles, wrapping our blankets around our shoulders. It's getting rather chilly. Someone complains in an undertone of feeling hungry. Agila hears this and immediately responds, "And what did you expect? Perhaps you'd like us to give you a girl to have a good time with. I've got a remedy for young hot bloods. You're feeling so lively, come and have a go at me." He clenches his fist in a boastful challenge. Let Chicano attack you. San Francisco. His men convoy us, lead us back to the Estadio Nacional, back to the same old sector under the stands. I was on the list of those marked for isolation, but at the time, I did not know that. The word of the officers meant nothing. So he might as well have kept his respect. Some of the questions he could have answered with more courage. Chapter 8. Exams. Nothing is going to happen to you here. Don't worry, we guarantee you this. But I repeat, everyone must play ball. There will be no breaking of the rules. You will get up at 6:30 in the morning. At 8, do the rooms. Stay open during the day. But no one will so much as put his head out, let alone come out. Soldiers are under orders to shoot offenders on sight. That will be all for the moment. You may turn in for the night. Sweet dreams. He leaves, closing the door behind him. We can hear the key turn in the lock and his footsteps as he walks away. Relaxing our set jaws, we breathe a sigh of relief. No more uniforms knocking about. No more submachine guns pushed into our ribs. That's a relief. We start looking for a more or less convenient place to lie down for the night. But we haven't got much of a choice, not much of a choice at all. They herded us into the footballers' locker room at the Estadio Nacional, stiff by now with cold, crowded, confined space, with our gray blankets about our shoulders, we dreamt only of lying on the floor as possible, stretching our tired legs, closing our eyes, and going to sleep. We're so packed together that try as you will, you can't find enough space on the floor to lie down in comfort. I pull off my blanket, and after deciding whether to spread it on the floor and lie on it, cover myself up with it, I squeeze myself between those already lying on the floor, the whole floor. The door of the dripping shower taps is covered with bodies, squashed up together. You can't put your foot anywhere without stepping on someone. The locker rooms represent a new and higher stage in terms of the treatment meted out to us by our military captains. And indeed, we are in relative comfort here. Proper toilets, washstands, and even showers. Besides, as a long-nosed and big-eared NCO has assured us, the Army had saved us from further beatings. At any rate, that was the message of the pompous address when we were brought here. True, we had stage after undergoing the none-too-pleasant interrogation at the neighboring cycle track, and after our personal files of the intelligence service had been checked. The archives of the intelligence service contained fairly detailed information on the connections between the overthrown legal government of President Allende and the Central Organization of Chilean Trade Unions, and on the party membership and our activities before September 11. It's all of us sleeping on the floor of the locker room of the Estadio Nacional had all been seized on September 11. The morning we were brought before our interrogators, there were about 300 of us. After the exam, about 80 of us came back with a good mark. More names were added to the list of those classified as provisionally released. About 6,000 people who were being grilled in the sun on the north stands. The 80 of us who were put in the locker room will have to stay here for an indefinite period. They will check the answers we gave at the interrogation and try to dig up additional evidence against us. Depending on whether they do or not, we shall either be released or subjected to another questioning. We don't know anything about the fate of the others. They were put in isolation after the interrogation and kept together with the prisoners. In the evening, we were moved again from the cycle track to the stadium, led soldiers from Punta Arenas. Our column, five abreast, marched through the marathon gates onto the football pitch, turned left, and proceeded along the running track towards the government stand. Our column was divided into three sections, those provisionally released at the head, followed by us, and those with particularly intensive interrogation bringing up the rear. The latter trudged along, supporting each other, and with their heads dropping onto their chest. One of those unfortunates, completely blind, put his head up and looking upward with his unseeing eyes, grasped the corner of the blanket over the shoulder of the man walking in front. This way helped to drag his unbending knees along with difficulty. Others were being carried by their comrades on blankets used as improvised hammocks. There were several exhausted, gaunt people who were just skin and bone after a month of starvation, nervous tension, and savage, cruel, torturous beatings. Women from the National Health Socialist Services marched through the same gate, returning from the cycle track, and turns right. They order us to stop by the roof over the main stand and wait for further instructions. off of floodlights around the stadium make the football pitch glisten brightly. The silence is broken. Rattle of machine gun bursts. To arms, prisoners get down. Hands on the back of your head. Several flares shoot up over the stadium, crackling as they fall. Down the aisles between the stands, firing their submachine guns. Our guards take cover behind the barrier, separating the football pitch from the stands and keep their guns trained on us. With the smell of cordite, soldiers crawl across the football pitch. There are flashes of gunfire all over the place. The stadium rifles and machine guns are firing away. Women have scattered. They lie flat on the ground. Some of them are crying. Our faces are peppered with cinders and dust kicked up by soldiers. At first, the raiders... I have to stop. Time for very desperately needed water. At first, the sight of the raiders shoot these bastards immediately. At first sight of the raiders, these bastards immediately. This is the only voice we heard during the whole incident. Later we heard the sound of running feet on the concrete roof over the stands, the clicking of bolts and shots. We saw smoking empty cartridges and explosions. Soldiers and officers bounded up the stairs towards the empty stands at the top as if possessed. Sticking their helmets on their rifles, they put the helmets up above, skirting barrier, shouting obscenities and keeping their heads down. Hey, you get up quick. In there, confused and bewildered, and ran in the direction indicated under a hail of blows, butts, and bayonets. All the locker rooms were closed, except one. They turned us about on the run. Falling over one another, we tremble and tumble through the open door. Operation Resettlement was over. The sound of the battle died down. Thing happened again a week later, we realized that the emergency stunt, which had a dual purpose, to boost the soldiers' morale and at the same time give us a practical demonstration of their fighting efficiency and readiness to riddle us with bullets at the first hint of rebellion. While inside the cramped and cold locker room, we passed the time whispering to one another and trying to keep warm, running six paces backwards or by jumping on the spot, waiting for the soup to be brought in, the half a cup that we got each day, which it was at 12 noon or at 4 p.m. or not. If they gave us bread in addition to the soup, everyone was free. It as he saw fit. We discussed in advance how we best use the bread. One method was to keep it in your pocket and nibble at it, to relieve the spasms of hunger which kept you awake, or to swallow the whole piece at once, a brief pleasure as the gruel masticated bread slid down your gullet. Pleasantly, the feeling of hunger was dulled, whichever method you used. Cigarettes, which was often, we got a fresh supply by a mysterious route from the soldiers who guarded us. Took part in the smoking ceremony. Each of us would drag on the cigarette and hand it on to the next man. The cigarette was passed around until it burned down to the bed. Then, a second and third cigarette. We smoked early in the morning. If the post service worked well, both in the morning and evening. Total strangers to one another. Before September 11th, we now lived like brothers, sharing with one another what we had, whether cigarettes, that bar of chocolate, they appeared, nobody knew from where, standing around with blankets spread on the ground like a tablecloth, now with quite long beards that had grown since stadium, watched with admiration as one of them, ordinary skill and deftness, split the bar into 80 equal pieces. double share, 2 bits of chocolate, who, like the rest of the younger prisoners, was depressed. At night we would hear him cry where he locked himself in. He suffered from hunger, ill-treatment, and crying was his way of letting off steam. But he put on a brave front in the presence of the prison officers, and we were proud of the youth. We never talked about ourselves. Sometimes people who had met before failed to recognize each other and only exchanged understanding glances. We knew that our captors had planted agents among us, whose job it was to eavesdrop and ferret out the names of those who were still at liberty. Days and weeks passed before we learned about the conditions in which other prisoners were being kept. We were indignant to learn that whereas there were 80 of us in our locker room, in the neighboring ones, from 120 to 150 prisoners were kept in the same space. Those who were kept inside the sewers were even worse off. To suffer the stench and complete darkness, and their feet washed by the sewage. They were always hungry and cold, and were bitten constantly by rats. We were taken out for a walk. We lined up in the crampled locker room, and one end of the rank stretched out into the corridor as we numbered something we had failed to see a few weeks ago. When we had run past this place, over the locker rooms fell off gradually towards the corridor, where it came down as low as a man's height and was surrounded by concrete pillars. From behind the pillars, where there was a small space forever cold and dank, dozens of pairs of human eyes stared across at us. Huge eyes on pinched, tortured faces. These unfortunates had been standing there stretched out in a long chain against the wall, day and night. The military putschists, those that took over, packed even the narrowest aisles at the stadium with hundreds of detainees, prisoners set aside for isolation, and kept them covered with 30 caliber machine guns. When one of them fell, no one was allowed to help him up. It was quite a risky maneuver for us to catch a suitable moment to throw a piece of bread or an unfinished cigarette. At least there was comradely amongst them. I'm afraid that's better than can be said for some of you in like circumstances. But many of us were prepared to run the risk of every time we were taken for a walk. We were prepared to run. One of us was sure to have something hidden in his pocket for those who were still worse off. Among the detainees in isolation, I saw OCL, OSIEL Nunez, the Student Federation of the State University of Technology. On that day, we had been left up on the stands for 4 or 5 minutes. Subsequently, the duration of our walks extended to 1 hour, then 3 hours, even 4 hours. The stadium was crammed to overflowing as if on the day of a major football match, but this time there was no game. Every seat on the stands under the roof occupied. People were crowded at their feet. Electronic scoreboard tower, the northern stands were packed to capacity only at the very top. One see an occasional unoccupied seat that was not taken up by a prisoner. Shirts hung out on the barrier separating the football pitch from the stands were fluttering and waving in the breeze. On the back of the seats and anywhere there were space, were dying, drying in the sun. Speakers round the stadium were turned on at full blast, blaring out songs sung by the Los Quincheros, Q-U-I-N-C-H-E-R-O-S, ensemble, and military marches of Nazi Germany were being played. A bazooka and machine guns set up over the stands, the whole stadium covered. A heavy machine gun was positioned at each corner of the football pitch. Inside the glassed-in commentators' booths, officers from the intelligence service scanned row after row of detainees through powerful field glasses. and had cameras with telescopic lenses. They were watching to see who talked with whom and who made what signs to whom. When we were left standing on the stands, until late in the evening, we could see long columns of exhausted, tortured people trudging along the cinder track. About a month after the coup, we noticed that some of the soldiers began to show signs of compassion.